Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. More than 40 million Americans are caregivers for family members, often their spouses or aging parents. My guest today had his life appended when he was thrust into the role of caregiver for his wife. Arthur Kleinman is a professor of psychiatry and medical anthropology at Harvard Medical School, and he also serves as the Esther and Sidney Rabb Professor of Anthropology for Harvard's Faculty of Arts and Sciences. He's had an illustrious career both as a practitioner and researcher, studying cross-cultural narratives of illness, particularly his work over the years in China. His wife Joan was his frequent collaborator, with a deep appreciation for Chinese culture, language, and scholarship, until she developed early-onset Alzheimer's in her 50s. Kleinman was forced to radically rethink and alter his life around his wife's failing memory and eyesight, and he was not one to shy away from the difficult parts of caregiving, including dressing, bathing, and toileting, all of which Joan eventually needed help with. Kleinman's decade-long devotion to her care is filled with darkness and difficult reflections on his own narcissism and the indignities visited on us by the American healthcare system, or lack thereof. Dr. Arthur Kleinman, psychiatrist, anthropologist, and author of the new memoir, The Soul of Care, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Arthur Kleinman, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by just having you take us through how you became a caregiver.
Well, you know, like many things in life, life intervenes, comes out of the blue. So when I was in my, middle 60s, my wife began to have unusual symptoms. She seemed to be going blind, and then she seemed to be losing her judgment. And I've been at Harvard Medical School for a long time, and my friends who are neurologists and others who are good at diagnosis worked very, very hard and came up with a diagnosis of early-onset Alzheimer's disease, which was a devastating diagnosis for her. And for me, a huge shock, because I was totally unprepared to be a caregiver. I had been receiving care from my wife for, up to that point, 36 years of marriage. And then we would go on for a terrible decade during which I took on increasingly the burden of care. But I started from scratch, from literally zero, because I had had such a privileged relationship that related to sort of an old-time marriage in which my wife was a stay-at-home mom, but she was a research assistant and associate of mine, and had herself became, over time, a very fine China scholar. But in which, in spite of the fact that she was very active in intellectual matters and academic matters, she did almost all the home care, from paying the bills through cooking the dinners to taking care of me and my our children. And all of a sudden, everything got turned on its head. And so simple things that almost anyone in the relationship should have been prepared for and doing on their own, I hadn't done. And I learned to do them, from paying the bills to cooking meals to helping bathe her, and increasingly to all the things you don't want to do, but you have to do, for example, with someone who's disabled, from feeding them to toileting them to everything else. And over the course of a decade, all of that got, in a sense, darker and darker in terms of the worsening of her functioning and increasing disability, and the burden on me physically and psychologically increased substantially. But over time, it was actually an important education for me in what I should have been socialized to understand earlier. And it made me a better person in doing it. I wouldn't want to ever go through that again, to inflict that again on my wife or on myself. But it made someone who was always interested in a purpose-driven life redefine what that purpose was, from writing and researching and taking care of patients to putting in all the effort as a family carer. And the astonishing thing to me was that here I was not just a physician, but a medical academic, a professor who had spent his entire career studying what I thought was caregiving, professional care. But I realized I had learned relatively little about family care until I had to become a family carer. And I also didn't understand nearly as much as I thought I had understood about family perceptions of professional care until I became a family carer. So it was a huge education for me. And I say it was a moral education because besides what I learned cognitively and how I emotionally matured during this process, it was a rethinking of the values, what was most valuable, most important in my life. That's the story. And then I interwove with that story the broader story of caregiving in America at our time for ordinary people like me and my wife facing serious diseases.
I want to touch on that, but I'm just struck by your wife's name was Joan and
right.
how epic, how biblical her illness was, because as you point out, you shared not only a love, physical, spiritual, and emotional love, but this great love of intellect, where she was a Chinese scholar, as you mentioned, and here you were building this, you know, massive, successful career, you know, first, I guess, at University of Washington, and I mean, even going as far back as Stanford, and then to Harvard as a tenured professor, both in the Faculty of Medicine and in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. I mean, really huge things. And then studying, as you point out, caregiving across cultures, China, Taiwan, many other places. So the cruel irony of both that illness affecting her mind, her judgment, you know, eventually her language, her behavior, making all of that so difficult. And then, as you pointed out, the irony of having studied caregiving in a sort of a formal fashion, but then having almost no practical experience with it. You mentioned the medical system, and you know, you were privileged by being in the Harvard system to know many specialists and get great medical attention. But in the memoir, you are not so laudatory about some of the specialists. In fact, you were kind of stunned at just how little caregiving they seemed to be able to engage with.
Yes, yes, absolutely. For example, my experience of neurologists at Harvard was that they were, well, the ones who dealt with my wife worked incredibly hard and were terrific diagnosticians. And as I said, probably made the diagnosis a year earlier than it would have been made somewhere else. But once they made the diagnosis, and that was it, they washed their hands of it. Not because they were unfriendly to us. Some of them were our friends. But because of the very professional training they had, they regarded their purpose as basically over, that now the caregiving had to be done by someone else. But the neurologists, whose bread and butter are stroke and neurodegenerative diseases, they need to be much more engaged with the issue of what happens after the diagnosis is made and those few medications that can be useful are used. What then? And that's all about care, and it's about family care, about certain kinds of professional care. And that's where you want their insight, very practical insight. So, for example, although I was meeting with incredibly brilliant people who were my friends, nobody at the beginning told me about the importance of a home health aide or getting my house ready for the period of disablement that Joan would have, let alone taking care of the emotional and moral aspects of care. But if you just take to the, you know, the practicalities, one of the most important things that happens in the care of those who have a serious dementia, where that person who has the dementia cannot, literally cannot use their judgment or their cognition in any way to take care of themselves, is to have access to what is called as a home health aide. So what made my life possible to continue doing my teaching and research and at the same time take care of Joan was that I took full care of her every weekend, and from 5 o'clock in the afternoon till 9 o'clock the next morning. But from 9 to 5, 5 days a week, I had a terrific family carer who was just wonderful and developed her own, not just her own relationship with Joan, but her own contributions to the care were enormous. Now, I lucked out. By the time I realized that I needed such a person and that there were a category of person like this, we were already 3 or 4 years into the disease, and I was literally using up all my energy and hardly able to function. And then all of a sudden recognized that I should have heard about this from the start and prepared for it. I was lucky because the person who came to work for us was fabulous. She was just simply fabulous. But I have many acquaintances and lots of knowledge from my own clinical practice of people who've had a dickens of a time finding family carers. So this is something from right from the first you want to have a home health aide, if, and you want to see if you have the means to afford such, or whether your insurance picks it up, or one of your assisted insurances like Medicare. You want to look into this, and right at the beginning, in the same way that, for example, Joan, who was not only seriously cognitively impaired with the Alzheimer's, but her Alzheimer's was atypical. In about 5% of Alzheimer's patients, the disease starts in the occipital lobe of the brain, which is responsible for interpreting vision. So Joan became functionally blind, as well as demented. And that meant that, you know, just getting around the space of her house became highly problematical. So reorganizing the house, you know, getting things under proper control, all that is the kind of thing one should be thinking about from the beginning. The same thing with meeting with a social worker and preparing for that inevitable day when you're no longer able to care for the person at home. After taking care of Joan for about 10 years, and the last 9 months of her life, she was in a cognitive care unit at a nursing home, a wonderful one in the Boston area, because I could no longer care for her in terms of this things required. She needed to have a lift that could get her out of a bath and onto a bed, or from a bed to a wheelchair, and she needed all kinds of specialty things. Well, again, I just lucked out because at the end we met the right people and I had enough pull in the system to get her into a number of places, but into the one place that mattered. But I didn't have the time to think through all of this, and had had someone laid it out for me at the beginning, I think it would have been incredibly helpful. And that's the role, I think, of the specialist you go to in a domain like neurology. You go to a neurologist or for other problems to a thoracic surgeon or a cardiologist. You want them not only to lay out the technical things that have to happen, but to give you a sense of, well, what's going to happen with this problem and what should we prepare for? And that simply wasn't done. And I see that kind of conversation as critical to care. That's part of what care really is about. Those are very difficult conversations, but they're extraordinarily important, and they need to be followed up on as well. So that dimension of care, I thought, was not well handled at all by the neurologists. It was well handled, interestingly enough, the people who sort of slotted in for the neurologist, who did a marvelous job of just being with us through the whole terrible decade, were our primary care physicians. We had one who then retired and another one who followed him. They were tremendous. They were great. They gave the message that we're here for you, that we'll be with you in this. No matter how bad it is, we'll be there with you in this, and we'll help you make choices, et cetera. That was wonderful. But, of course, they're not specialists in this, so they didn't really know what the real issues were we were going to face. And then, you know, along the course of this experience, of this decade-long experience, I had other eye-opening observations that illuminated parts of the healthcare system that I had been relatively unfamiliar with. And even where I had some familiarity, it wasn't deep, it wasn't intimate. So going, for example, with my wonderful adult son and daughter were just a fantastic support for myself and for my wife. And I went with them, the two of them, and my daughter, my son, and myself, to look at nursing homes and assisted living facilities. And again, no one sort of had prepared us to how do you think about these? How do you make decisions about where to go and, you know, what's appropriate? So we just did it off the cuff and visited about two dozen in the Boston area, and were appalled at many of them, at the sort of level that people were kept. They were sort of almost like homes for dying, and there was such an awful atmosphere in many of them, of lack of activity, sort of a pervasive sense of people who were not fully washed and not properly cared for, or sort of left to just vegetate. And it's a bleak terrain to visit and to begin to try to map for yourself and figure out well, when the time comes when I can't handle this anymore, what do I have in the way of alternatives? And again, I think that that's absolutely crucial and something that should be a central part of what caregiving for Alzheimer's is about, but it isn't there.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Arthur Kleinman, author of the new memoir, The Soul of Care, The Moral Education of a Husband and a Doctor. Dr. Arthur Kleinman, we were talking about finding placement for Joan, your wife, toward the end of her life, and how, in fact, when you and your adult children looked at these two dozen places, most of them, it seemed like, were just really warehousing individuals awaiting death rather than being proactive and caregiving. And you mentioned there was one beautiful passage where you talk about having people exposed to light in a bright, you know, not the nicest facility perhaps, but making the most of what they had, where the individuals were brought into a sunroom, and there were activities, there were games, there was singing, there was music. I mean, there was a life of the mind going on, even for people with minds suffering from illnesses. And it was astonishing, and I think one of your takeaways was that it was crucial to have a director or someone in charge who felt a distinct sense of purpose rather than just running an organization, but felt it was a passion.
Yeah, no, you said it better than I could. That's exactly what we found, that I'd say most of the places we visited were just disappointing and desperately saddening, but a few of them were really impressive. And even impressive with very limited financial and other resources. And in those cases, it was these remarkable directors who were all women. They had all come from backgrounds of multi-generational involvement with nursing homes. And they were all deeply committed to dementia care and to creating the kind of environment where the humanness, the liveliness, the core energies and personality of each of the inhabitants were encouraged, and no matter how disabled they were physically or cognitively. And it was quite startling and impressive and made us realize that this was a moral commitment. And that's one of the points that I'm making in the book. After all, like the subtitle is The Moral Education of a Husband and a Doctor. One of the points I'm making is that care is not just a set of activities, but it involves a moral commitment. It's there to do, and you do it. It's as fundamental as any existential thing you could do, and it's based in the relationships we have and the primacy of relationships, which goes against an awful lot that our society misleads us about. So the tremendous emphasis on libertarianism in our society, or the emphasis that you spend all the time on yourself, and then innately you will find who you are inside yourself, I think all of that is not just nonsense, it's a dangerous nonsense. That you find who you are by doing what's important for others and yourself. And you find what's important in life in relationships. You find what's important for yourself, the deepest part of yourself, through relationships. And that's what care is. Care is a relationship. So that if you are a doctor or a nurse or a physical therapist or an occupational therapist or a home health aide, anyone involved in caregiving, your relationship with the person you're taking care of, with the people you're taking care of, that is crucial. That's central. And we have forgotten that. And everything in our healthcare system, in our political economy, has driven us away from that so that we... If you look at how much time doctors spend now with patients and their families, they're spending more time with the representative of insurance companies and health plans on the phone arguing, usually advocating for their patients, than they are with the patients. They're spending much more time with the computers than with their patients because the electronic medical record is enormously important from a technological standpoint, but so complex, usually, that doctors find themselves frustrated. They can't In the time they have available, they can't even spend most of that time speaking to their patient who's in front of them or actually behind them because they may be looking at the screen and talking over their shoulder, which is the worst of all ways of practicing. But they may have to do that because they've got to find out for a diabetic patient, what's the blood sugar? What are the electrolytes? What's happening with this patient? from a standpoint of blood test and for a patient who's a follow-up patient for cancer, there's all the scans to look at to see how is the cancer progressed and the like. Well, to find these and the way they populate an electronic record is one of the most frustrating and time-consuming experiences. So the doctors are not looking at the screen because they don't want to speak to the patient. They're looking at the screen because they need this information to speak to the patient and take care of things, but it occupies an enormous amount of their time. And they end up, in my view, in a situation that everyone loses in. The patient and the family lose because they don't have that acknowledgement and affirmation coming from the doctor that, I know who you are, I know the sickness you have, I understand what you're here for, and I'm here to help you. They don't have the emotional response. They don't have the moral commitment. And they don't have the straightforward examination of the context of the history of the what's going on in people's lives that are so important for understanding the treatment. And so at the end, the actual care is poor. The quality of care is poor. And here I'm defining the core of care as the relationship. The quality of the relationships are poor or poorer than they should be. And yet none of that is mentioned in our endless discussions about health care in American society. Those discussions, from my perspective, have largely fallen away from the central focus on care in order to talk only or principally about economics and institutional efficiency.
And
the fact of the matter is, and many of your listeners may not know this, that we have no direct measures of the quality of care. There are no direct measures of the quality of care. Because in order to measure that, you'd have to measure the skills that physicians have in transmitting ideas to patients about their diagnosis and treatment. You'd have to measure the quality of the communication, the quality of the relationship, the emotional tone and support, et cetera. We don't measure any of those things. Instead, what we do is we use institutional measures of efficiency, which measure the number of patients who did this, the number of patients who did that, outcome in the crudest and most superficial of manners. And by doing this, we fulfill the political economic emphasis in American healthcare, which is on efficiency, managerial control, and other bureaucratic standards, and we fit into the economic models of care, but we don't pay any attention or very little attention or too little attention to the emotional and moral dimensions of care, which are the most crucial things for patients and families. That's what's most crucial for patients and families. They want good care for themselves and for their family members. They want assistance with that. We're not doing that. We're not emphasizing that. We're talking about something else. It's as if there were two realities and where they make us blind to the other. If you focus on one, you seem to be blind to the other. And the reality that we're focused on in American healthcare systems is systems reality of the bureaucratic needs, the economic constraints, those burdens we're looking at, and those opportunities. But from the caregiving side, it's a totally different language. It's the language of support, of understanding, of meaning, of responding to the requests of families and patients, of knowing what their needs are and helping with that. And that is just missing from the kind of discussion that we're having. And from my perspective, it's wholly hypocritical to hear people who run healthcare systems talk about quality of care. They're not interested in quality of care. They're interested in institutional efficiency and financial balance sheets. And I think that we've got to reverse things. We have to have a healthcare system where the core of the system, the very center of the system, is caregiving. And then all the other things fall into place.
Well, I want to ask you about something that really surprised me and saddened me a little bit, which was a lot of your career, it seems like, was focused on what was called an explanatory model of an illness, or what came to be called, I think, illness narratives. And this was something that I think you saw across cultures. And it seems like early in your career or through much of your middle career, you were pushing, say, American medical students and residents to really pursue how patients viewed their own illnesses and gave language and emotion to those models, because otherwise it's what you suggest. It just was a series of checkboxes and vital signs and things that didn't add up to a whole. But I think in one of your articles, you basically said that it seemed like they had gotten the gospel and they were asking patients for their illness narratives, but it was as if they were being trivialized and reported almost as another piece of data, like a vital sign. And then the students and residents wound up stereotyping patients and their stories into certain categories. I guess I was so sad to hear that.
Yeah, well, I think you got it exactly right, that it was a sad experience for me. I wrote a book called The Illness Narratives. This was back in 1988. And many American medical schools picked up on the idea of training medical students in how to elicit patient and family explanatory models and how to respond to them, et cetera. But what ended up was that I would be invited to a medical school and to give a lecture. And then after the lecture, I'd make rounds with the students and residents. And they'd show me Mr. Jones. And I'd say, this is Mr. Jones. This is his age. This is his disease. This is his explanatory model, as if the explanatory model was unchanging and all you needed to get it was once, put it in the chart, and then forget about it. I meant this approach to open up conversations between doctors and patients. And what I discovered is that the medical leviathan made use of it to close conversations and give the seeming sense that there had been a conversation, at least one conversation. And so I don't repudiate what I recommended. I still recommend it, but I don't recommend it as a single thing that then gets fixed in the medical record and then forgotten about. This is sort of an ongoing process of communicating between families, patients, and doctors. And on this side, I think the other thing I learned that in my experience with Joan that I hadn't fully appreciated in my research was how frequently the family is left out of the conversation between a patient and a doctor. So just think of how serious a problem this is. If a 75-year-old man has just had his gallbladder removed and is returning to his home where his 76-year-old wife is going to take care of him, and she's already has some limits in what you can do and the like, but he comes home after 3 days in the hospital with two tubes coming out of his abdomen, and neither the nurses nor the doctors have had the time to carefully explain to the family members what they should do when someone comes home with two tubes. And the wife sees that, and the adult children see that, and they're scared stiff. They're afraid, will my father get infected? How do we clean these? Can he take a bath with them? It's those simple questions that are the everyday concrete details that are central to care. Care is the doing of all these concrete, small, straightforward things. And if you don't have that imagination as a nurse and a doctor that this is what the family is going to have to be doing to help take care of this person when they get home, then you failed your task. And we know from a report of the National Academy of Medicine several years ago called Families Caring for an Aging America that what I just described to you is commonplace, is the routine, not the exception. And I think that's another sign of the failure of care.
The name of the memoir is The Soul of Care, and it's about the moral education of a husband and a doctor. And that husband and doctor is my guest today, Dr. Arthur Kleinman. Dr. Kleinman, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. And I wish that all your listeners will, whether they read the book or not, think very seriously about care, because it's so important in all our lives.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.